At seminary, theological students are introduced to the mysteries. And ranked high above the mysteries to which aspiring ministers are introduced are the miracles of Jesus. Theological students study the miracles of Jesus the same way medical students study the miracles of the human body. They dissect them, sort them, categorize them. They endeavor to understand how and why each of the miracles functions within the entire system of the Jesus narrative. The miracles of Jesus are typically sorted into three distinct groups. First, and most plentiful of all the miracles, are the healing miracles. There are physical healing miracles and mental or spiritual healing miracles. The physical healings, for instance, the healing of the paralytic, of the 10 lepers, the woman with the flow of blood, giving of sight to blind Bartimaeus. And then there are the healings of the mind or spirit, exorcisms, the New Testament calls them. The exorcisms of the Gerasene demoniac, of a young boy, of a woman in the synagogue in Capernaum. And second, the second group are the resurrection miracles. The raising of Jairus' daughter, the raising of the young man from Nain, the raising from the dead of Jesus' dear, dear friend, Lazarus. And ultimately, and most wonderfully, Jesus' own resurrection from the dead. So healing and resurrection. And the third category are the nature miracles. The stilling of the storm, Jesus walking on the water, the great catch of fish, the withering of that poor fig tree, and the fish out of whose mouth is discovered a golden coin. In addition, among the nature miracles, there is a subcategory. My favorite category of all the miracles is this subcategory of the nature miracles, sometimes called the refreshment miracles. The refreshment miracles, there's really just two, although one of them is repeated a couple of times, the multiplication of the loaves and the fishes, the big picnic, right? And Jesus' first miracle, his debut miracle, his miraculous turning of water into wine, not just any wine, fine wine, good wine, complex and velvety wine. And not just at any time or place, but at a wedding. On the sanctuary's north wall up there, you'll notice the gallery's empty. We've asked people to be up here so you could see over there. I'm sorry the sun isn't back there to help you, but those tall tracery windows are all a different miracle story. Five different miracle stories. And clergy who sit here a lot end up looking at things like that a lot and wondering about them. And I wondered why, of five miracle stories, three of them are from one category. Three of the five depict miracles of resurrection, beginning with the one nearest the front, nearest the organ pipes, is the resurrection of Jesus. The next one in towards you is the resurrection or the raising of Lazarus from the dead. And then skipping the central one, going over one more, is the raising of Jairus' daughter, who had died. Three of five windows concerned with death and resurrection. When you have five chances to depict five different miracles, why would you pick three from one category? Why so much attention to death and dying and rising? I don't know for certain, but I will tell you what I do know. I do know that the Civil War had ended just 10 years prior to the completion of this building. That Massachusetts sent over 150,000 troops, 14,000 of whom died. And many more returned wounded, maimed, and forever changed. And I know this, that this building was completed in 1875, smack in the middle of the Industrial Revolution. Built during an era of unprecedented expansion. The era of railroads, canals, turnpikes. The era of the mechanization of agriculture. The era of mills. But it was also the era of crowded cities, of factory towns, long hours, squalid conditions, disease, the death of children, and a high worker mortality rate. And I also know this, that it was in 1872 that Boston's Great Fire ravaged this city. Raging from the common all the way to the waterfront, Boston's Great Fire reduced 1,000 businesses to ashes and killed 30 people, including 12 firefighters, and singed this congregation's former meeting house. The Great Fire's flame licked at our steeple, charred our shutters, and blackened our pews. Boston's Great Fire rendered our Old South meeting house unusable. And I also know this, that in 1874, during the building of this building, when they were probably making decisions about those windows, a dam gave way on the Mill River in western Massachusetts. A wall of water between 20 and 40 feet high and 300 feet wide rushed downstream, and almost everything in its path was destroyed. Enormous factories were reduced to stone rubble or splintered planks of wood. Houses swept off their foundations and collapsed. Cows, horses, people were sucked into the roiling water and tossed around like rag dolls. Within an hour, within 60 minutes of the breaking of that dam, the flood had leveled 4 entire villages in western Massachusetts. Finally, it reached a broad plain just outside of Northampton, and there the river spread out over acres of fields, depositing its awful contents, machinery, furniture, bridges, rocks, trees, livestock, and human bodies. It took days to recover the 139 people who lost their lives to the Mill River flood. Now back up there again, the window closest to the back. The window depicts the miracle of Jesus' stilling of the storm at sea. Jesus commands the wind and the waves, and they obey him. And I know this, that Boston and New England are storm-prone and storm-tossed. As a port city and a fishing port, Boston knew and knows all too well the power of nor'easters, gale force winds and rogue waves, the tragedy of shipwreck and the incidents of death and dismemberment so high among commercial fishermen. Not many years before those windows were chosen, still fresh in the horrified memories of Bostonians, there was the fate of the brig, the St. John. The St. John was filled with Irish immigrants, 100 Irish immigrants, men, women, and children, fleeing the potato famine, seeking a new life in this new world. Their voyage had been a good one, safe and weather-free. And just as they were nearing the end of their long passage, just off the coast of Cohasset, within sight and sound of land, a storm suddenly brewed. Gale force winds and waves as high as mountains, it was reported, drove their brig into an underwater ledge. The impact broke her back and opened her seams, and she began to break up. Those below decks were drowned within minutes. Horrified spectators looking from the land saw passengers by the dozens swept off the deck and into the boiling surf. And even though they were deafened by the howling of the wind and the thundering of the seas, the watchers on shore were convinced, reported, that they heard the screams of those unfortunates as they were sucked down into the maelstrom and to their deaths. I don't know about you, but I am beginning to understand the choice of four of those five windows. A preoccupation with the harrowing presence of death and the great brute powers of nature, fierce, wild, sudden, terrifying. So what then of the central window? As I build my case, I ask you to look opposite to the south wall. I won't make you spend a lot of time looking backwards. The central window, these are the parable windows. These are the miracle windows. These tell five parable stories. And the central window is the parable of the Good Samaritan, arguably the most important parable story, the most famous parable story of Jesus, the parable of the Good Samaritan. And I assume that by locating this most important parable in the center of the five windows, our forebears meant to give to the parable of the Good Samaritan pride of place. If I'm right about that, then we can assume that our forebears also meant to give pride of place to the central window here, the story of Jesus' first miracle, his debut miracle, the turning of water into wine at the wedding in Cana of Galilee. And here is what I take from this. That these windows speak to us of what is true and real of our lives. That everyone dies, but not everyone lives fully. The central window is an invitation and a reminder to us to fully live when we can. In the midst of life's vicissitudes, life's storms and perils, to seek out and ourselves to author spots of joy, oases of refreshment. As Jesus rightly sensed, a wedding is just such an occasion, an oasis of refreshment, a reminder that despite death and pain, despite grief and weariness, hunger and disease, there are in our world here and now occasions of great joy, of utter and unbounded love. The evocation of love, the glad revelry of a party, moments of good cheer and gaiety, the promise of new life. Today, then, we pause in the midst of a world bruised with violence, a world stalked by disease, a world of terrorists and pirates, fanatics and the desperate. We pause for a moment today from an economy that lurches and stumbles, reeling toward disaster. We pause today to refresh ourselves with the power of love, the beauty of commitment, the tender strength of two persons who dare to make brave and faithful promises to each other, to God, and to themselves. I bring you a miracle. The miracle of this, that for a moment the storms are stilled, death is frustrated, and love wins. Amen.